By the latest Beef and Lamb New Zealand Economic Service stats, approximately 65%, possibly more, of New Zealand's beef production comes from cattle that were either born on a dairy farm or born to cows with some dairy genetics in their background somewhere, such as, and we were discussing this before the call, the trusty Hereford Friesian that's in parts of the country. But so that's a lot of beef. And it reinforces, I guess, the importance of dairying as a support industry for sheep and beef in New Zealand. But getting dairy cows reliably in calf and safely getting calf out of her are clearly important. But at the same time, if that beef calf out of the dairy cow grows faster or produces a better quality beef, however that's measured, then clearly the cumulative effect for agriculture in New Zealand is huge, and as we'll talk about later tonight, it's significant at a farm level as well. Not to mention, and we might touch a bit on this tonight, we've touched on it in some of our earlier calls, the issue of social license to operate around farming now, and the whole issue of what happens to a whole lot of bobby calves coming out of the dairy industry and whether we can find a productive use for them. So tonight's discussion is about whether there are opportunities for a win-win here for both the dairy and the beef operations. Can better beef genetics make more money for both dairy farmers and beef farmers? And if so, how can we make it work successfully? Beef and Lamb New Zealand, as you'll hear tonight, funded the Dairy Beef Integration Project to answer some of those questions and more. And we're joined by two gentlemen who have been involved in the project and involved in beef production and dairy production for some time. So firstly, welcome Doug Lynham. Doug, probably easiest if I hand over to you. You introduce yourself, what you do for a day job, and you tell me you're trying to retire, but what have you done up till now?
Good evening, everybody. Doug Lynham. I come from the New Zealand meat industry as the track and career that I've taken. And one of the things that set me alight on this whole subject was seeing bobby calves arrive at a plant for slaughter. And I used to think to myself, what a wicked waste of raw material. And that's gone on over the years. So I thought, rather than just think about it, it's time to do something about it. Hence the birth of the Dairy Beef Integration Project. And I'm pleased to be able to contribute to that discussion this evening, and I'm looking forward to partaking.
Thanks, Doug. And our next guest tonight is not Rick Burke, despite what we advertise. Rick, I think a number of you will know, but a busy bloke and had unfortunately ended up double booked. So we've got an able fill in for him, and a number of you know Bob Thompson from Ag First. Bob, I think we'll get you to do the usual introduction. You've been on one of these calls before, which is actually the first time somebody's been on for a second one, so we're making history tonight. But you were involved with the project, and you've been involved with this sort of thing a fair bit in your working career?
Yes, good evening all. As most of you will know, I'm involved in farm consultancy, and I've specialised in sheep and beef, and perhaps more particularly in beef. And so over the years, yes, we've had strong involvement with dairy beef. I guess going back to the 70s, some listeners may remember this, we had the New Zealand Beef Breed Evaluation Trials, and they came up into the early 80s. And through that, we discovered that dairy beef cows were, in fact, some of our most productive cows. It probably still holds true today. They haven't been picked up at any great level. There's still some out there that use them. So that's been one of the areas I've been involved. But of course, another byproduct has been the Friesian bull, and bull farming has been a profitable option for many farmers too. But I guess tonight we're wanting to expand that conversation past just Friesian bulls to other opportunities we might have in this space.
So before I get into that, actually brings up a question, is that we've talked about the bulls, we've talked about dairy cross beef cows, but what's is there particular issues at the moment that make it a great time for both dairy and beef farmers to be thinking more about beef, using better beef genetics to produce those surplus calves?
Certainly,
in the dairy industry?
Certainly, Aaron, because we're coming up to mating decision time. As calves are landing on the ground, I always think it's a good time to start getting the messages out there for decisions to be taken when making the decisions on mating in the new season. Because the mating decision is one that's taken, and it takes nearly a year for that calf to arrive. So I think we owe it to the farming community to be able to put those messages out in plenty of time, so that when the farmer's evaluating what they might do for their mating in 2017, what are the options available to them? What are the good options? What are the best options? What options would probably suit them the best?
And so, Bob, we were talking, there seems to be a bit of interest. I mean, is it just the fact there's a bit of money in beef and people are paying more all the way down through the chain, or is there other things driving sort of interest in this stuff at the moment?
Yeah, it seems that there are a few stars that have come into alignment just right at the moment. And I guess one of them is the bobby calf issue, as Doug has mentioned. And we do need to find some solutions. Of course, there's challenges that spin off the back of that too. Where are they going to be farmed, and how land use competitive will they be? And our listeners won't need reminding, I guess, that, you know, we've lost 1 million hectares of prime finishing land to dairying, and that has presented its own problems, not the least of which has been bobby calves. But there's also some environmental challenges that sit there as well. And I know thinking dairy farmers are wondering what they can do in this space and how we can add value. I think added to that, you know, our technology has improved. You know, we're getting better at heat detection down on the dairy farm. That's which right, has one of been one of the impediments to a dairy beef program. Because I think, you know, when it boils down there and we start getting down to nitty gritty, we need to be able to present a value proposition to the dairy farmer and a value proposition to the beef farmer.
Yep.
And I think probably, Doug, we've been guilty over time, looking back, of just thinking the dairy farmer's there just to use. We'll give him a bull and he can use it and that's the end of it. What we were thinking about selfishly was our value proposition on the beef side, not perhaps thinking enough about the dairy farmer. So I think now we're a bit more thoughtful. When we look at genetics, we see that there are some beef genetics out there, but like we'll probably get into this discussion a little later about where our traditional beef breeds have taken us in this space. But when we're talking to a dairy farmer, the two key value propositions are around calving ease and gestation length.
I think one of the key areas in there is that we've had the us and them syndrome for too long, where we've had the beef farmer and we've had the dairy farmer. And I think one of the most important things that beef councils have done is they've brought the dairy farmer to the beef council table so that they can sit around the same table and discuss the opportunities available to each party and how they might work better together to achieve something for everybody.
All right.
I think also what's helped facilitate this discussion is Beef and Lamb invested in the Dairy Beef Integration Program. And again, we saw some hard data around what a good beef bull can do and what just a run-of-the-mill beef bull could do and the risks and what have you that associated with bulls of unknown genetic specification.
That's a good segue, Bob, bringing up the subject. Just before I get on to that, I mean, we know with the podcast at the moment, another plug, we're getting on some of the topics, we get a good following from the dairy industry. So hopefully there's a number of dairy farmers out there listening to this as well and listening to what you two are going to share tonight. And it's not just trying to preach to the beef farmers. So, all right, the Dairy Beef Integration Project, what was the point? What was the purpose of it? Why'd you pull it together and get it started?
We had the stories and we had the hearsay, but that wasn't good enough. We need to record and we need to prove and we need to be seen to be recording and we need to be seen to proving. So we selected a dairy herd, we selected supporters that had beef semen, beef bulls available, and we went about making a project and making it real. And to make it real, we secured DNA profiling for the sire, the dam and the calf when it was born. And we also said, now what are the other things we can look at while we're doing this? So instead of just being a calf program, we've researched everything we could along the way. So the data that came out in the Dairy Beef Integration Report was data that was confirmed by actual work and traceability. And I think that gave the stance of being the first meaningful report that had data in it that could actually be substantiated. And I think that was a wonderful starting point, because now we were getting some real data and saying, this is what we found, and this is what happened, and this is what happened between that dam, that sire, and that calf.
Yep. So who was involved? Who was the instigator, got off the ground, before we start getting into what you did find? And how you did it?
Beef and Lamb New Zealand were right in behind this, and the Mid-Northern Farmer Council we're right in behind that as well as an adjunct of beef and or whatever, because we're just as interested as you are in the result forthcoming. So that's how it came along. And then I went to LIC and LIC said, look, we're happy to do the DNA testing for you, because we believe down the road there is something in this for us as a semen industry as well. Mm-hmm. So that's how it came together and away we went. So we took the from mating to calving to finishing those animals, taking them right through to slaughter.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so look, just before we dig into it any deeper and get into it, it's, suspense is known to be bad for you, so let's give it the Cliff Notes summary at the start. What's the key messages that came out of the project?
That the bobby calf is a waste. What can we do with a four-day-old calf? Turn left a bobby calf for $20, turn right as a feeder calf for $100. There's an opportunity for a financial contribution at 4 days of age for that calf to the dairy farmer, particularly at a time when the payout was dropping. Mm-hmm. So there was an opportunity to pick up something straight away.
Yep. That's for the dairy farmer. What about for the beef finisher on that side of things?
70% of all cattle born in New Zealand are born on a dairy farm, so the commercial beef finisher was looking for new avenues of raw material. Here was an opportunity to collaborate with the dairy industry to get raw material that suited his business. And then sitting way back just behind that again was the processor, who was saying to the commercial beef finisher, I haven't got enough prime beef, I need more prime beef. So gradually we linked everybody together and said, this is a project that has interest for all factors and all sectors of the industry. Let's work through this together, let's communicate, let's make the information available to everybody so everybody can then make decisions that are best suited to their sector of the puzzle.
Yep. And we're going to dig in depth, but listening to the podcast tonight or the conference call, the podcast, not the only way people can get information, there was a published report.
Yes, it's all on the Beef and Lamb website. Yep. Yes.
Great.
And it's been there year on year, and each year we come out with messages for pre-mating. We'll do that every year to keep people up to date with the latest information.
Good as gold. Now, we'll, when we send out the links to this and on the podcast channel, we'll put links to the full report and there's a fact sheet as well, which sort of summarises the key points. So, all right, let's just a bit more around the methodology then. How long did it run for? How many years? And how many bulls did you use? And
ran for 3 years. We took an adjunct of 150 cows out of the herd, and we used Hereford semen, and then we used Hereford bulls as a follow-up. And to get a benchmark, we also used proven easy calf Hereford sires, and then bought some Hereford bulls in that were of no particular merit, but because they were traceable within the project, we could see what they delivered to us. And there was no question that the easy calf calves landed on the ground slightly lighter at birth, but were just caught up by the 100-day and 100-kilo weight gain.
Okay. All right, so let's get into some of those technical findings. So the EBVs for lower birth weights proved that in practice they actually worked.
Yes, they do. And I think the interesting thing in discovering that, we've now taken another step and we're starting to talk about things of short gestation now, because the more we can bring together, the more opportunities we make for the decision at mating time. This animal has got the EBVs for ease of calving, but it also now has an EBV that's coming for short gestation. So it means it can come to me 3 or 4 days earlier. So the more that we can do of that, this is a continuing story. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity.
So what sort of birth weights were you getting out of those?
I haven't got them all on the top of my head, and I'm not sure that they're in that report that's sitting right in front of me. But generally speaking, we were about 3.4 kilos lighter, I think.
Yeah, three and a half to four kilos lighter.
And the lower birth weight for calving ease and those sorts of things, did you see significant differences in the ease of calving?
There was no assistance required in those easy calving sires, no assistance required at all, but in the, where the bulls of no particular merit were used, there was assistance required in three cases.
Okay, out of how many? Out of 100 or so?
150 animals in the project. So
3 to 4% of the needed assistance, but zero in the selected bulls. You were only dealing with mixed age cows though?
Yes, we were. We were dealing with mixed age and mixed breed too. We had Holstein Friesian cows, we had Kiwi cows, we had Jersey Cross cows. And we did that deliberately so that we didn't have just a segmented result. we wanted to reflect as much of the commercial dairy industry as we could.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't try it over heifers at all, though?
No, we didn't. We didn't have heifers available to us. Okay. And one of the reasons for that is Tokanui is a science farm as well as a dairy farm, and we had a window of opportunity where we were working and we weren't able to do that.
Okay. So, and this is probably, so this is your guess, and Bob, you want to chip in here as well. Do you think the same principles you found in this would apply to heifers, first calves as well?
I'm sure it would. I'm sure it would, because what one would do when making the decisions for mating heifers is I'd look for more of those EBVs that better suited the mating to a heifer. Right. Yeah.
I think to give a farmer confidence that he's got a good bull for mating over heifers, generally you'll find those in a straw rather than on a hoof.
Yeah.
Because they've been proven. Uh-huh. And so there's a real case for synchronising heifers and mating them AI.
Yeah.
Albeit for one cycle and following up with something that known to be easy calving behind that on the hoof. But certainly the biggest value propositions are represented in a straw and not on a hoof.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to come back to something you mentioned, Doug. EBVs for low birth weights, fine, but what about gestation length for those beef bulls being used across the
world? Well, that's part of the voyage of discovery, and whilst we went initially looking for ease of calving, short gestation made itself apparent to us. So I think that's something particularly for the future, and the reason I say for the future is because the semen companies now see a role for them to do some serious work in the delivery of beef semen to the dairy industry. So, and it's an area they've paid lip service before and sort of had a beef pack program or something like that. But now semen companies are absolutely saying we need to make this a part of our business and we need to get closer to dairy farmers with the beef opportunity. Mm-hmm. Because if it produces more revenue for the dairy farmer, then the dairy farmer has the opportunity to spend more money with the semen company, obviously. So I think you're going to see a lot more work in the next 2 or 3 years in that area with semen companies in particular. And I agree with Bob that the that proven semen comes more in a straw than in the live animal.
And there'll be pressure, yeah, like you say, there's pressure. The results of this work and the sort of thing we're doing here hopefully create more demand, and that should just put more.
Well, year on year, the semen companies are telling us that in the last 3 years, the demand for semen has gone up 50% per annum. Mm-hmm. Now, while that might have come off a small enough base at the start, the trend line is the thing to look for, and that it's going up 50% each year. So that's showing that the world is taking an interest in what's available and what's happening here.
Do you want to add to that, Bob?
I guess the thing is that I'm not sure whether you want to get into this now, but I've done quite a recent study on genetics, and I've done this because we're actually involved in a commercial dairy beef program, and in the course of setting it up, as I mentioned earlier, it's so important to look at value propositions for the people that are in the team, and as Doug said, we need to learn to play together as a team with this. And so when we looked at the dairy farmer proposition, we came to this conclusion that a dairy farmer should be able to use a beef bull and know that he's going to get an easy calving. He shouldn't have to worry about that. And as Doug's already pointed out, what the beef and lamb dairy beef integration program taught us was that if you're just buying bulls run of the mill on the hoof without records, there's a risk that you're going to get more difficult calvings. Interestingly, following on behind this program was a beef and lamb genetics dairy beef program. Now, many of our listeners will know about the 4 beef progeny test programs that beef and lamb genetics have invested in around the country. This is a dairy beef program. 700 cows at Limestone Downs. First crop of calves last mating. Another crop of calves coming on the ground now. And same story that we heard from the dairy beef integration program. Same story. Now, unrecorded bulls are risky. And so coming back and then looking for genetics, I got the genetic trend lines for New Zealand Angus and New Zealand Hereford because I believe those two breeds are our best bets. Why? Because they afford shorter gestations than most all of the other breeds. Most of our European breeds have longer gestations. And so you've got a whole lot more ground to make up. If you go to the literature and look at the science around this, you find that Herefords are 2 to 3 days longer than Friesian. Angus are the same as Friesian with respect to gestation length, which is where the money is for a dairy farmer. If you go to something like a Simmental, and they're probably one of the better of the European breeds in terms of gestation length, they're about 5.5 days longer. Now, every time you say day and you've got a dairy cow and milk, you're talking at $6 a kilo, $9 a day. And at $7 a kilo, obviously it's closer to 10. So it's money in the bank. And so gestation is important to a dairy farmer. And so the bulls that we've chosen in our program are all bulls that have a gestation advantage and a value proposition to dairy farmers. And the thing is, as I was saying before, the bulls that are different and afford the value proposition have been progeny tested. They have good accuracy numbers around them, so you can use them with confidence. But they're also right out on the end of the bell-shaped curve for the breed. They're outliers. And so it's very interesting. So again, the value proposition is with AI bulls. Why? Because they're highly selected bulls that you wouldn't normally be able to get on the hoof.
So two things I want to just pick up on there before I actually drill into that a wee bit more. One is I've got a copy of, there's an article on the Beef and Lamb Genetics website about the progeny test you referred to. We'll include the link to that. The second thing is, if I'm reading what both of you have said there rightly, this is quite a challenge, as well as an opportunity, there's quite a challenge here for beef breeders in New Zealand in terms of...
Yeah, there is. There's a new track for beef breeders to go down as they do their traditional work. And I think we have an obligation to make people aware of that. So a lot of these things that happen in genetics happen by way of discovery. So that if a beef breeder discovers something that's got a shorter gestation length, now can I have a meaningful relationship with the dairy entity that gets me a step further down the track? And it's a step further for the beef producer in his relationship. It's a step further for the dairy farmer in his business to get cows over the bucket just a little quicker. And as Bob says, $9 a day production early in the season, it's worth having every day you can over the bucket.
But Bob, you mentioned they're sort of on the outliers on the curve, some of these key animals. So you, is that saying there's not a lot of them out there in the beef industry at the moment?
So the little study that I did on genetics was really interesting, and I was so pleased to get that in, that data from New Zealand Hereford and New Zealand Angus. Now these are breed, group breed, this is group breed plan data. Now farmers that understand group breed plan data will know that when they go for calving ease, you look for a breeding value, an EBV, called calving ease direct, which is a combo of gestation length, birth weight, and actually recorded calvings. And so that's the calving ease direct. Now when we look at the genetic trend lines for Hereford, we see that they've made some quite good progress. And some would argue maybe, you know, compared to Angus, were they a little more difficult than Angus? Well, who knows, because we haven't got any real good data on that. But certainly they've made good progress in the last 10 years, 7 to 10 years. When we look at Angus, they've made less progress in calving ease direct. Angus breeders would maintain they already had quite good calving ease direct results. But the other, and as I said to you before, I believe that a dairy farmer should be able to use a beef bull with confidence, knowing that he will not get calving difficulty. So we need to sort bulls out such that that is the case. So as I said before, the next value proposition is gestation length. If we look at gestation length genetic trends for Hereford, we find in the last 20 years, they've dropped that by 1.1 days, so minus 1.1 days. For Angus, minus 1.8. So they've made slightly more progress. Now, breed averages are interesting, Aaron, but the and listeners, but they're really interesting. There are breeders that have been more deliberate and focused on bulls that have better value propositions. So in our dairy beef program, it's not by chance that we've selected 3 Angus breeders and a couple of Hereford breeders. You know, and it could have been just 2 and 2, just how it worked out. And so there we have it. Some breeders have been more purposeful in the way they breed. Mm-hmm. And we need to find the breeders, and then we need to find bulls that's within right. that yeah, breeder's yeah, herd. That'll help us.
Right. Mm. Okay.
Very good. Mm.
So let's get into some specifics. You said, you know, the best way to get access to those bulls or the breed is going to be through a straw, coming in a straw. What were the costs, though, for getting that in your program? Was it costing more to use that?
Generally speaking, beef semen is cheaper than dairy semen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see any reason for that to change. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the semen companies have the ability to take an ejaculation from a bull and split it into so many straws that they can make high volumes of semen available in a very short time. Like I think LIC in the peak of the season are putting out 100,000 straws of semen a day. So it just shows you the volumes available. If you take a percentage of that of being beef, one bull can have so many opportunities by the semen straw, whereas the bull can't be present on every farm around the district or the region. Mm-hmm. So I agree that I think the semen straw is the opportunity. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that really sits behind that gives me confidence now is that the semen companies have woken up and given a commitment now to having beef semen as a working part of their portfolio of opportunity for dairy clients.
Yes, it's not just cheaper, it's not going to be hard to find either for a dairy farm.
Before it was just a beef pack, semen pack, now it's going to have some real data and some information because they see it as a positive role for them going forward in their business.
Okay. So we're going to keep digging into the benefits of using that, but that's one cost with the straws of beef semen versus dairy semen. What about the cost of just using beef AI versus just having a bull running around, is it?
Well, I think once again, at that time of the year, the technician is available and the work's being done, and the technician is probably coming to the farm anyway to do insemination. So it's a matter of the farmer selecting what animals are to go to what straw. Mm-hmm. And I think, come back to this, any old bull is any old bull. And just to ring an agent and say, look, I want six bulls here by Thursday to tail up my herd, is opening your herd up to all sorts of risk, and not just risk through performance, but risk through disease. And so we know that there's a disease outbreak at the moment that's caused a bit of concern in our locality. That's not to say that won't happen again somewhere else in the future, whereas if it comes out of a straw, it's proven not only as what's in the straw, but the authenticity of the organisation that's presenting the semen to you has got their name and their guarantee behind that product as well.
And just pick up on a word you used there about, you know, tailing up and using the bulls to chase up. In your project, though, you're actually making the beef mating decision before mating started. You identified the cows that were going to beef genetics weren't just those that didn't get in calf at the start. It was...
That's right. We made decisions as we went, and we used beef semen, then we used proven beef bulls naturally, then we tailed up what was left with ordinary Hereford bulls to give us the three categories. There's where we selected with semen, there's where we used natural mating to give us a benchmark, and then we had natural mating with any old bull at all just to see what came out of the animal.
The advantage the dairy farmer has early on, he knew which cows were lower production worth or breeding.
Exactly,
he can
select the semen, select the female, and make the coupling that suits him best.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll come back to some of the stuff on the dairy farm. Let's talk a little bit about from the point of view of finishing as well on the beef. EBVs for lower birth weights. What did that translate into live weight gain and time to finishing and carcass weight?
There was no loss in live weight gain. The lighter calves caught up with the other calves in the ordinary time. There was no difference there at all. Yeah.
How long after birth before they were catching up? Was it 100 days?
At weaning time, the weights were...
At weaning?
Yeah.
It was a similar result at limestone downs. By weaning, they pretty much caught up very soon after. So, you know, these are curve bender bulls. Mm. So not only have they been selected for easy carving, and a component of that is lower birth weight, but they have good post-birth growth rates. And as well as that, when we went searching for bulls with value, not only were we looking at bulls that had good growth rates, in other words, they're at least up around breed average for growth for 400 and 600 days EBVs, but also we were interested in looking at intramuscular fat, because we know all the consumer tests that have been done, consumers have this real preference for marbled beef. and the EBV IMF is pointing us in that direction. So again, these curve bender bulls, these outlier bulls, they bring this package to you that's not only got the value proposition for the dairy farmer, but they've got great value propositions for the beef farmer. And this is really where we need to get to, I think, to make the difference.
So just specify what you're talking about there when you mean curve benders. So there's a genetic correlation between lower birth weight and slower or smaller adult size, slower live weight gain. These are animals, though, they're actually breaking that.
They're breaking that. So there's a correlation, as our listeners will know, between alveolar growth traits. So birth weight, 200 a day, 400, 600, and even mature weight. But what we find is that there are individual bulls in genetics that will break some of that to a point where we get a lower birth weight, we get the good post-birth growth rates, but the other really interesting thing from a beef breeding perspective, and I guess we're stepping outside of dairy beef just now, but mature cow size can also be held back, but at the same time have a bull that has a great 600-day EBV. And so this is where we really need to be, because these cows that have lower, you know, they end up in commercial beef herds with lower mature cow size, are obviously more efficient. Now, they're just as productive, but they're producing a calf at a lesser weight. Now, I'm digressing, sorry, Aaron, in business, but it's just a little, it's just illustrating the power of genetics. And I think that we've sort of neglected them a little bit. So we're playing a bit of catch up.
And I think while Bob was talking about catch-up on the breeding side and opportunity, I think there's another area too that we haven't yet connected with completely, and we need to, and that's the linkage with the processor. We've got the semen now going into the cow, we've got the calf being born, we've got the calf growing in now, and we're learning all the attributes of that. But what about the attributes of when it comes to harvest time, when it comes to slaughtering that animal? What are the attributes of that animal that can be traced right back through its lifetime so that we can look and see for all of the outstanding qualities of that animal right back to birth, right back to the semen straw, so we can go to the semen company and say that straw there delivered this in its lifetime through this process. And the more data we gather and the more involved we have the processor, we have an opportunity to look for the curve benders, as Bob calls them, right through their lifetime. And I think a wonderful example of that at the moment is the EQ program that's now available in the industry, where you can look at eating quality. So dairy beef has a role to play on that. Dairy beef's as good as traditional beef. It's just that we need to highlight it and demonstrate and show people where, how, why, and what happened to make that as good as it was.
I'm going to come back to that quality issue, and that's why I like podcasts, because we can go wherever the discussion takes us, which is great. I will just throw in another plug there. We had Steve Morris on a few months ago and talking about cow size and efficiency and some of that stuff. So what Bob's just touched on there, if you want a full hour on that topic, go and listen to Steve Morris's podcast. Last question, though, specifically on the genetic stuff. Again, the low birth weight EBVs panned out in reality just as they had said on paper. You're telling me the live weight gain EBVs did the same?
Yes.
So
They work.
Easy answer. All right. What's that? We've got these animals, so we've talked about the dairy side. They're on a beef farm. What was that worth to the beef farmer? These getting these better beef genetics rather than just any old beef genetics out of a dairy cow and...
Well, I think the worth to an ordinary everyday farmer is the fact that he knows that he has an animal that has the opportunity to put his head down, take grass, convert it to muscle, and keep growing. Now, I will admit that in a bit of a trial, we struck a couple of very dry years, so we perhaps didn't get the opportunities that we might have really desired in our trial. But it still allowed us to grow the animals as a commercial farmer would. It still allowed us to farm them as a commercial farmer would. And it still allowed us to present those animals at a target live weight to the processor so we can look at them going through slaughter and then look at fat colour, meat colour and all those sorts of things and keep recording that data so that we know that that animal produced these score points to us, and that becomes part of our library, because as the library grows and the data becomes deeper, we will be able to make more and more informed decisions for producers on just what is going to make a difference in their farming operation.
Yep. So Bob, this is your day job. These are, what's this worth to a beef farmer? Is it worth them paying more for these improved beef genetics out of the dairy industry?
No, we're not suggesting they pay more.
No.
Why would they?
Okay.
I'm thinking that maybe they'd pay less. Because, you know, the traditional weaner sales have been seriously competitive. And that's been great news for the commercial beef breeder. But when it comes down to hard, cold margins, I don't expect that, you know, anybody should be claiming more. It's just about getting your ducks lined up in a row and getting better value out of the current system.
But these animals will make a beef farmer more money.
They'll make just as much money. Because they're from a breed value perspective, breeding value perspective, we discussed before, they'll grow just as fast as an average Angus or Hereford mated to. Are you with me? So they're up there in the pack.
Without the cash outlay.
So, what's the value driver? Why does the figures on paper look good? We've seen all these things. Why would the industry make this step change? I mean, obviously something's driving it. What's the?
Well, I think let's go back and look at the 4-day-old calf, because I think that's where it all starts. So the 4-day-old calf at the dairy farmer's gate turns left as a bobby for 20 or 30 bucks. Let's not argue about a dollar or two, somewhere in that thing. Today, at 4 days of age, the calf can turn right as a beef cross feeder calf at $100 more. Well, the market's showing us right at the moment it can be $200 more, in some cases more than that, but let's keep our feet on the ground. Let's say right at this moment that 25 is a bobby and 125 is a feeder. There is a $100 opportunity sitting there for the dairy farmer having made the appropriate decision at mating the year before. And I think that's the first step we need to take. I think the second step in that is that the calf rearer, if they want a beef cross animal, they know that they're now becoming available. I personally think at the moment they're a bit dear, but supply and demand will see that over time as the project grows. The commercial beef farmer can then look to the calf and say, he's rearing these animals of this known merit. I know now that I can enter into a relationship with that calf rearer and source my raw material without having to search far and wide across New Zealand looking for raw material. I'm beginning to understand what's coming to me, knowing its genetic merit, knowing how it's been farmed in its lifetime. It's got its traceability, so when I present to the processor, I can actually be a link in the chain for the lifetime of that animal that suits the information going to the consumer. Because at the end of the day, if we haven't done everything right and the consumer wants a little bit more on information, then we break the link. So I think it's preparing for the next step in the chain, passing it along to the next person, information intact, opportunities available.
I think, Aaron, at the beginning, you gave us a bit of an industry situation review around numbers. And it's close to 70% of beef cattle is of dairy origin. Also, 50%, 49% I think is the actual number, of beef, prime beef cattle is of dairy origin. And so if we think about increasing numbers, it's got to come from the dairy, 5 million dairy cows that we've got. Because, you know, unfortunately, our beef herd is decreasing. We have less than a million beef breeding cows now. And you cannot see them increasing anytime soon. There may be a little bit of an upsurge with, you know, the current beef prices and disaffected sheep farmers thinking about where can they get some beef dollars from. But by and large, I think, you know, if we're realistic about this, I think if we are to increase the number of beef cattle available to us, they will need to come from dairy beef. So that's the reality check. Where I think the big opportunity is not just breeding them and you know, and hoping and praying that there's going to be a market for them. We need to start connecting dairy breeders with professional calf rearers and with finishers and then back to the processor exporter, where this product, with the extra value that sits in around it, a value story, which is going to include the environment, going to include animal welfare, all those sorts of, a great story around the calf having a life, and then marketing that, there's real opportunity there. And I know beef and lamb are working hard in this space. And I just want to say that the program we've got We're just embarking on a dairy beef program. That has been helped by the RMPP, the Red Meat Profit Partnership. Yep. And that's helping us get going. And I think it's going to be a great outcome for RMPP, but more particularly for the farmers that pay the money that goes into it. So quite excited about it.
And there are a proportion of processors that are now thinking seriously about the role they have to take up in the future to secure the volumes they want and to become the link in the chain of information, the story of the animal, the story of the procurement of the material and the relationship with the consumer. The processor has a real role to play here going forward, and I think you're going to see big changes in that area over the coming months.
So let's talk about, again, another handy segue, let's talk about from the processing side of things. We've talked quantity to a degree here, you know, live weight, days in milk, all that sort of thing, and live weight gains, carcass weights, that sort of thing. But what about the end use animal? What did you find out either in the project or both of you in your wider experience about the eating quality and some of those sorts of things out of these animals? Were we seeing advantages there from using these improved genetics as well?
Well, I think the first thing and the comforting thing is there were no disadvantages. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say that is quite deliberate, because the advantages come by the way the animals are handled. Now, in this project, we knew how to handle the animals because pH and the like is fully manageable. Mm-hmm. So we knew how to prepare the animals for going to slaughter, and that worked. So we had no issues. But I think that the real key thing there is, what does the processor want? Getting this relationship, getting into discussion with the processor, what do you want, when do you want it, how do you want it, and how can I as a farmer fulfill that need in a way that he's going to reward me appropriately? And I think it's time for the processing sector and the farming sector to get really, really much closer together and talk about what they want, not just I'm growing this and this is what I've got for sale. What do you want, when do you want it, how do you want it, how can we get together to make it a win-win for each other?
I think we need to point to the science. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of science done on traditional beef versus dairy beef. And without doubt, whether it be New Zealand science or overseas science, it all says the same thing. There is no difference between traditional British breeds and dairy beef. Whereas, you know, most often, it's suggested that there is. But various programs that processes are run, and I'm hoping I'm not talking out of turn here, but to the best of my knowledge, even the EQ program, there is not one breed that is shown to be better than another. Well, that's sort of, it's not unexpected if you think what the science has taught us about that. So, and this relates to yield even. And so there's a very good paper that I think Beef and Lamb commissioned for Dr. Paul Muir to write about this. It was published last year in the Journal of Science, and that reviews all of the research that we know about that, and that would be a great paper to put on the website. Aaron, because I think some of our listeners would be very interested to read that.
So that was a review of dairy beef characteristics
versus traditional beef.
Thinking about processing, all of the judgment of the carcass at the processing plant is done after the jacket has come off. It matters not what jacket the animal is wearing. It matters what the score of the animal is after the jacket's come off. And that's what I like as a processor, to be able to go and score all those carcasses, get all the attributes recorded down and say, that was that and this was this. Now tell me what breed it was. I only want to know afterwards, because I want to score without having my thinking clouded by what breed it was. Tell me that afterwards, and then I can start to put some data together.
Sounds like the steak of origin competition, where they don't know what they are until they've tasted them, and then lo and behold, they get some interesting breeds that win. But I just want to come back to what you touched on, Bob, where you were talking about the various eating quality measurements that have gone out there, and you mentioned you said there's no one breed that was better than the others. Flip that around, and we were talking, the key question there is, though, was there anything worse than the rest?
No, to the best of my knowledge, there wasn't. From the reports that I've seen at two public field days where that data was presented. And so, no is the answer.
Yeah, but what it does show, what it does show, and there's an opportunity sitting in there that I see, wearing my processor's hat, that if every farmer presented me with 100 animals, Why did one get 70 through and one get 40 through and one get 55 through? Uh-huh. Therein lies a whole lot of questions, and then we can take back to the farm and say, here's your score sheet. Now let's have a look at why you scored 70 out of 100, yet this fellow over here scored 55, or that one 40, whatever the numbers might be. So there's always questions becoming available when score sheets are put out for scrutiny. So I think there's a whole lot of opportunity sitting there as well. And once again, that can all translate back through the chain to dairy beef, because if we've got animals traceable in their lifetime, we will know exactly on which side of the street they came from.
So we are digressing a wee bit here, but you know, the classic equation is phenotype or performance is genetics times environment. So what you're saying here is if that phenotype characteristic we're measuring is eating quality, it's the differences are largely, if not entirely, coming down to environment management, feed.
What I am saying is that there's opportunities at every corner. And the first opportunity we talked about was at 4 days of age. Uh-huh. Then there's the weaning weight. Then there's this age. Then there's that age. And looking back at what are all the opportunities for everyone that's in the chain to be able to better perform their piece and be better rewarded, so that at the end of the line, the consumer's getting something that's absolutely fit for purpose every time.
So there's always two parts to this. Yep. There's the genetic part and there's the environmental part.
That's right.
And it's not one or the other, it's both.
Uh-huh.
And we shouldn't, I think, get into saying, oh, it's 90% feeding, you know, Aaron. It's actually, we have both. What the ratio is incidental. You need both.
And but have we over-egged it and said it's genetic? You know, people would mention some breeds are good and some
aren't. And Doug and I know that pre-slaughter management and post-slaughter management are two core things to deliver a great product.
That's right.
And then wrap in some good genetics into that as well, and you're starting to get somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, it's putting all of the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together. I think of the genetic trend lines. Mm-hmm. And like Angus to be commended. I commended Hereford for their improvement in calving ease before. If you look at the Angus data, you want to see the improvement they've made in intramuscular fat, marbling. And you know, the Angus Pure program has driven a chunk of that, I'd suggest. And so they've made some big differences. And that's worth capturing and using, because we know from consumer studies, I think we mentioned that before, if all of the consumer studies that have been done that I've seen, show that what consumers want is tenderness and intramuscular fat, or marbling, that we call it. Those are the things they like.
Because of what the characteristics are. Last couple of questions. So we've sort of dug into that a fair bit. The last couple of questions I just want to tidy up with. From a beef finisher or beef farmer's point of view, the value of the end product's all well and good, but ultimately to them it's their margin they make per hectare, per kilogram of dry matter consumed. And the classic winner in that has been bull beef, because it's so efficient at turning grass into what may be a low value product, but the margin's reasonable. How do these better beef genetics out of the dairy herd compare with a bull beef finishing unit?
Well, they
sounds good, but is it going to compete?
Unless we get a premium for this product, bulls will continue to be more profitable. And it's just like biology's against us. You know, we're dealing with heifers and steers. So straight away, we take some natural growth promoters away from them. You know, and so our industry does need to grab this prime thing by the scruff, because, you know, we need for these prime cattle to be as profitable as bulls. And so therein lies the challenge. And the way we're going to do this is surely by differentiating it in the market and putting that story against it. And so in our dairy beef program with Greenlee, our hope and dream is that Greenlee will take us to that higher place, and they'll get help. And I believe, you know, that we'll get there.
I think it's fair to say also that while we found outliers In every project we've done, there will be outliers in the heifer and steer market too. It's just that we haven't discovered them yet. And I think we need to put more focus into that area. Bulls are one thing, and when you've got a steer, you've taken some of the natural ability to grow out of it. But there will still be outliers in that sector. And we just need to keep searching for this data. And when we get it, test the data, make sure it's credible, and then share the data. because in every opportunity is sitting there, it's just got to be discovered.
Mm. Now, it's just one of my head issues that ultimately it's not the value that's the issue, it's the margin.
That's it.
And that's where beef might be a low value, bull beef might be a low value product, but they're just so bloody good at producing it.
That's it.
Okay, look, going to wrap up. We've talked about a lot of, that's one little fish, or one potential drawback, but there's never a free lunch. We've talked about some of the things that work well. What were some of the costs and issues here, either for the dairy farmer or the beef farmer in this? Start using better beef genetics.
I think too often we've looked at costs as being a negative against the business when we should have perhaps gone through all our costs and worked out what was an investment and what was an expense. And I think the hindsight teaches you a lot of that. So I think you go, record what you do, be thorough in what you do, and analyse the results carefully, because I think what you thought was a cost on the one hand might well have been a good investment for you.
Bob, is there anything in this, you know, that the issues, challenges, risks?
Yeah, I think, you know, when we think about the dairy farmer, we know, if we've, the calculations we've done show quite clearly that AI is a better proposition than natural mating if you do your arithmetic. The issue for the dairy farmer is heat detection. So they've already done like 5 weeks of AI or maybe even six, and now you're asking them to do some more. And they're saying, well, actually, you know, I've had about a gutsful of this. And so unless we can provide them a real good value propositions, is it worth it? So the real challenge is, and I believe it rests with gestation length, and that was, this is a message I'd leave with us. It sits in gestation length for the dairy farmer. And like the bulls that we've got on offer, the best bulls offering $50 advantage just on gestation length for the dairy farmer. That's this year. And we know that's going to get more and more and more. And that's at $6 payout, and they're more likely to get $7. Yeah, and so that's where it's at. Heat detection, ease of detecting cows, and getting them mated AI. If we could make that easy, and there's some real cool stuff coming around. We picked up a little heat detector thing from Gallagher's the other day, which is pretty smart. And it's more and more of these that come into the market, and so it's making it easier and easier for the dairy farmer. But there are those sorts of challenges.
Right. Any last words, gentlemen, you want to add before we wrap up?
I think one of the words that we need to write down in all of this is communication. We've thought about a lot of things as individuals in our particular slots within the business, but we need to communicate with people to the left of us, to the right of us, in front of us and behind us, to make sure that we are aware of all the opportunities that are available to us, like they are aware of the opportunities available to them as well. Communication is a great tool in the life of farming, and I would just encourage people to communicate.
I think if I could add a little bit, I would say that we need to communicate with some formal processes. In this particular case that we're talking about, it's contracts. And as New Zealanders, as Kiwis, we're so fiercely independent, wanting to do our own thing, take our own opportunities and stuff. But our future with this will hinge on back-to-back contracts that take us right to the market and afford that customer, consumer, something of advantage to them. And that's a real opportunity for us. And with synthetic protein, burning our backsides as well, didn't mention that when we start, we need to get out of the commodity ruck. And the way to do that is to do the sorts of things that we've been talking about.
Excellent.
All right. Where you might want a contract today, tomorrow it will become a relationship where a contract's not even needed. Just get down the track and let's get cracking with this. There's so much to be done and so little time to do it.
Excellent. All right. On that, I am going to pull it to a close. We've covered the questions that have come in. We've covered most of the issues I wanted to cover tonight. Obviously, people can go back and listen to the podcast again. And just to sum up, there's a full report that came out of the project. It's available on the Beef and Lamb website. Yeah. We'll link to that. There's a basic fact sheet for the summary of it.
Beef and Lamb Genetics website.
Beef and Lamb Genetics website. We'll link to that article. We'll try and dig up that for those that are right into their technical detail. It was a published review that Paul Muir did. And so the bits and pieces are well out there, and you guys have an ongoing extension and communication program around the outcomes of this, don't you? Reminding people what's going on. All right, very good. Look, thank you very much to Bob Thompson from Ag First and Doug Lynham from Hearts Unknown. Semi-retired, for coming in tonight and going through this stuff. And no, I've really enjoyed the discussion. It's interesting topic. We know we get a lot of interest in it, and I'm sure we're going to get a lot of people following up on the podcast. So, and finally, to all of you out there, look, thank you very much for calling in. Next podcast, or next conference call, is in about a month. It's another challenge and issue. We actually got Paul Kenyon talking about hobbit lambing, so it's another one that tends to get a fair bit of debate going. So we'll let you know when the details are coming up for that. But in the meantime, thanks very much for ringing in, and good night.